Hey, you know, we all love to go out to eat. Who doesn't like to go to a kitchen, to a restaurant? But what happens behind the kitchen doors? Is it all creativity and fun? Is it all craziness? I don't know. We're going to find out with a couple of crazy people here today who are going to tell us a little bit about what that experience
is like. Either crazy
one. I'll throw you both in there under the bus. Chef Pascal, who'd you bring today? You're not sure?
It's a whole package.
A whole package.
You know, and Paddy Glennon.
A good Irishman like me.
Chef Paddy, yes. And we just talk about Ireland, but we're not going to spend 2 hours talking about it because
we could, though.
No, because we don't have a good beer.
Yeah, a little scotch.
Right? And so, yeah, I met Paddy, I have to say, about 40 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. He was really young. And
he was really young.
You were still old, or no?
You were both young, right?
Yeah. And I was so impressed by that human being. Very, so much energy, never stopped, work hard. Was speaking French, and then I learned about his background that we're going to talk about, and he's still involved, and he's really helpful in the culinary community, and everybody loves him in Orange County, all the chefs.
What impressed me, and I knew you guys would go through this, but you sent me his bio. I couldn't put it all on one page. Not only is he trained by top Michelin star chefs and France,
yeah,
Italy, all those places, but he apparently was, we're going to hear about that, award-winning chef with a James Beard House recognition?
Yes,
yeah.
And on others. Okay, tell us a little bit of some of your awards.
You know, I don't look at awards as, you know, I'm plate by plate, day by day, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
I'm always like, you're only as good as what you're doing today,
yeah,
you know,
that's
in our
true
business. You know, we, you know, in the early days, Food Network, we were on the early shows in the very beginning,
yeah,
and through the early part of Food Network, we were on often, you know, and, you know, we did, back then, you know, now you have Iron Chef. Back then it was Ready, Set, Cook, if you remember.
Yeah, yeah,
and Ready, Set, Cook is you went against other chefs, and I beat Martin Yang, I beat Wolfgang Puck. I was undefeated. Yeah, I think I was like 7-8 times on that show. Always undefeated, fast. And you had to create a dish in, like, I think it was like 20 minutes,
yeah,
back then.
From scratch.
Like, yeah.
You know, he's a kind of chef, bang, bang, bang,
yeah,
bang, done.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, we did a lot of different TV pilots over the years. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I can't say I ever got famous, but I was always on the edge of the breakthrough.
You are famous in the whole world of the food.
Yeah.
And I got to ask, Bizarre Foods, because that's a bizarre show.
What, yeah, Andrew Zimmern, a few times we did his show. And he came to our fish company one time and did a full walkthrough, and we were going through all the unique kinds of fish and items you can buy here in the Pacific. Everything from sea cucumbers to urchins and things like that was what we dined upon,
yeah,
in the coolers. Yeah.
So from being a chef with a Michelin star level restaurant, we met at a restaurant called Antoine. It was really one of the top restaurants in 1984 to 1990 at the Meridian Hotel. And he was also working with a French chef consultant, a three-star chef that came on. And the consultant chef, French chef, and him work very well together. And then the kitchen was fantastic. It was, there's no restaurant of that level anymore in Orange County.
No.
And there was really...
doesn't exist.
No.
Is that because there isn't an audience for it, or it's unaffordable?
Well, you know, you know, we do have like Marché Moderne.
Yeah.
We have Knife Pleat. I mean, they're doing fantastic work.
Yes.
Knife Pleat people,
yeah,
talk about all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic restaurants of a high level. And back then, you know, there was less rules when it came to employees. You know, we worked 5-6 hours a day off the clock before they let us punch in to work,
right,
on the clock.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and it was just the amount of work that goes into that type of cuisine, and luckily for me, those same gentlemen, Bruno Serino and Jacques Maxima, they sent me to France to work, and I was there for about 7 years in France.
Not just to polish your French, but
But even in those kitchens in France, during season, like, there is no such thing as time off. There is no such thing as days off. You go like 5-6 months and.
But hard work, that's what you say, hard work is no big deal for you.
Yeah,
you,
no big deal.
No,
yeah,
that's a way to be.
So it's just not plausible to put the kind of effort
the type
and
of
hours
work,
into it.
Yeah, the type of work in today's modern employee, you know, how much we have to pay chefs and cooks and servers and things now.
Yeah, and they got to get a break after 15 minutes or 4 hours or whatever.
There are wonderful restaurants here. Yeah. There, I don't think of that level. Orange County will support the price tag it would cost to make dishes like that today.
And one of the actually even the chef from Orange County used to come on visit, like Joachim Spiegel, who created Patina.
Joachim
used to come regularly and check you out, guys.
Yeah,
it was amazing. It was a special time. It was the top fame of. Wolfgang Puck and Joachim, the whole thing, and you were right there.
You're rattling off all the big names I heard of when I came to California
and
in the 80s. Yeah.
I'll tell you maybe something you didn't know. When I left, I was at the Le Grand Hotel in Saint-Jean-de-Luz, and Bruno left. And usually when you're a Michelin restaurant in France,
you lose the stuff.
You either destroy the kitchen on your way out, or you start a new kitchen. That's how you do it, right? And he was leaving, so he destroyed the kitchen, so I was one of his top guys. He gave me the choice to go to Robichon, Paris, back with Alain Ducasse, who was at that time, he was in Monte Carlo already. And
the guy you studied with, Chef? Or did you start with Alain Ducasse? No.
No.
There was somebody.
I work with Alain Ducasse in France. Right. But anyways, or go back to the United States, and I gave the offer out with my people around me at that time. They chose America, so I was like, went back to America. But I was forbidden to work with Joachim.
Wow.
I was forbidden to work with Michel Richard.
Yeah.
I was forbidden to work with the top of the
You're
food
kidding.
Of that time because. Back then, there was no internet. There was no YouTube. There was no Instagram.
So you have to spy.
Yeah. So you have to spy. Yeah. So for me to come from the top things happening in France and bring it back to America and work under these guys, those guys wouldn't have it.
No.
You know, if I was smart enough to know, I would have gone to work with those guys because those guys were the greats of.
You would have.
Yeah. I would have had an easier go, you know.
Yeah. Michel Richard was amazing.
Oh, Michel. And I knew him over time. You know, we had a lot of mutual friends and respect. But at that time, I was forbidden to work with those guys because I had the new technology of France and Spain was coming up at that time.
So I was lucky enough to work in the same environment kitchen, but a different restaurant in that hotel. But I always sneak in.
Sniff around.
His beautiful deconstructed lobster. Put it back on the plate. It looked like a full lobster, but all decortiqué and beautiful, and put some tortellini on bottom, and beautiful lobster sauce. That's fantastic.
That presentation alone, how do you present, how do you plate stuff like that? That takes a while.
It's crazy, and you know, as things in France, like my chef would go into San Sebastian, Spain, to the market where they do everything pêche à la ligne, everything caught by hand, by line, right?
Oh.
And he would buy the fish of that morning, which would be in rigor mortis at the time. Mm-hmm. We couldn't use that until maybe nighttime service or maybe lunch the next day. So we were always like one day ahead for the fish to get through rigor mortis. Mm-hmm. But literally, you don't touch the fish until the order comes in.
Yeah.
And then you have to scale it, fillet it, pin bone it, order by order by order with your crew.
And we used
that
to
was
have,
crazy.
We used to have overnight fish flowing from France or from not Denmark but Netherlands.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and Felix Van Stad.
Yeah, Felix, and they used to pick it up at the airport and bring it straight to us. You know, unbelievable.
Yeah,
and then you work after that with Chris Carlton.
Yeah, I was a long time with Christian Racineau for a while.
Yeah.
I own restaurants in LA myself. One of my groups that we had, we owned about four restaurants in LA at the same time. Yeah. We were very well known as Italian Trattorias, but we opened Fleetwood's LA Blues with Mick Fleetwood at the time, and we had liquor license problems, and it was a difficult time.
Yeah, I think it was really extreme.
Oh my God, man! Yeah, so. But it was, you know, a great time. Very artistic. Everything was artistic. Mm-hmm. Everything was about art, cuisine, food. And money never crossed our minds.
But you try Hollywood.
Oh yeah, yeah. We did Hollywood. Yeah, I was. I ran the Bellage, Mondrian, Vernet, Le Parc hotels all at
that's
once.
That's probably what gave you the exposure to the Food Network and all these medias.
Yeah.
So here's my question. I hear all that, and I'm impressed, and we can talk all day about that because I love all that. But somewhere along the way, you switched sides to become into the purveyors.
Yes.
You left the kitchen and you're...
I have to say, kind of the path he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I rarely see that, usually.
He was involved because Paddy is very a big advocate of sustainability.
Sustainability.
You know, sustainability.
Right.
And respectful farming and respectful fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And was involved actually with the
ecology center.
No. In Monterey.
Monterey
Bay Aquarium.
Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Okay.
Yeah. And he was an advocate for them. And so he brought back all that knowledge to us, chef, to say, hey, don't buy that fish. It's not been cut right. And this is a farming salmon. Don't use this one. So he gave us, you know, the tip to get the best seafood and the best fish available.
With the least environmental impact.
Yeah.
So is that what led you into the purveyor side and out of the kitchen door?
Honestly, what led me into that was complete burnout. You know, it was...
did a lot of
it was complete, but, you know, like, if you look at my life in the kitchens, I was always like, I was working here, being flown to Chicago to consult there, to do... It was like complete burnout.
Can we talk something about outside of your kitchen life?
Yeah.
Being burnout?
Yeah. If you want, yeah.
He used, I don't know if you do, he used to fight sport fights. And can you say a few words on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, especially in France, I started young when I was a kid. Where I worked out, where I was young, policemen had a boxing club there. And I, unbeknownst to my mother, who didn't want me to fight, I fought. And I was able, through different parts of my life, to work with great, very well-known professional fighters. But when I went to France to make money, I had done some prize fighting. And when I went to France to make money, because we were paid well under minimum wage, we would get in these tournaments, almost like cockfighting, you know, and the rich people would bet on you. But you'd make enough money, you know, to live okay, so, and be able to go to the nightclub.
The reason
I
bring that up, because that gave you the character. You know, he's a fighter, and he never stopped. He still, you know, fight for on his own just to in his living. But how many times do you break your hips?
My hips, never broke my hips, but I have my knees replaced, my hands have been broken so many times. My nose, I'm beautiful, you know, but my nose is broken at least 9 times, I think.
So Chef tells me once in a while there's some fights break out behind the kitchen doors. Did you ever participate in any of that? I mean, people throwing stuff at each other?
If they broke out, they ended quick, you know.
No, but it's usually verbal fights.
Yeah, verbal fights. Yeah, the you know, the that style of kitchen, I hope, doesn't exist anymore, because there was some negativity to that too, you know. Especially when I worked in Europe, like during season, if you weren't, the amount of hours and the pressure you were under of perfection at all times, people would break down. So literally they'd be breaking down, tears would be coming out of their eyes, tears would hit the plate, then they get ripped for tears hitting the plate. And people would like have nervous, you know, I was in kitchens where people literally had nervous breakdowns. And the way we were, you just step over those people and keep working.
I experienced that because we were strong. And sometimes some cooks could not handle the strongness.
Yeah.
Just push them aside and keep
push
going.
Push them aside, keep going.
But they would never been messing up with him because they know.
Yeah. They know his other side here. So, but that's what we see on TV, the Gordon Ramsay's and stuff, or the Hell Kitchen.
Well, Gordon Ramsay, it's great. He's a great guy, and he's a great chef. That's kind of a show where they get a bunch of chuckleheads, knuckleheads together, and yell at them basically for fun.
Sure.
Like they don't on those Hell's Kitchen.
They sang a waiver first.
Yeah, huh? They don't put people on there that know what they're doing. They set the show up to be catastrophic.
Yeah,
you know?
Character oriented.
You know, you're Top Chef and things like that. That's more of a that's a fun thing where people go through a gauntlet of many different challenges and things, and people have risen up from there. You know, a lot of my friends that have gone on there, and one or even one of my really close friends, he came in fourth. He's one of the most prolific restaurateurs in America, you know. He just got out there and put himself on the early shows, and for some people, that's their pathway now to being known, you know. Like when you were saying what awards you get, I actually want to shy away from that, because I have garnered a lot in my life, but that doesn't do anything about today.
Yeah.
So I'm very much like, what are we doing today?
So now I'm back today. Now you, we call you the fishmonger.
Yeah.
All right.
So, did they really use that term still, like the 1700s or something?
Yeah, it's there's a few of us that are fishmongers that are actual, have worked professional boats, that have filleted fish all our lives, have worked hard in the fish industry. So like when chefs ask me about something in spring, it's not like, I'll find out in spring. It's like, no, I know what's going to happen. I know what will be available or not available approximately. Yeah. Like, cause we know, it's part of our DNA now, you know?
And so, do you actually talk to the boats and the captains?
A lot of the way that works in California is there's smaller boat fisheries in Southern California here. The rockfish fishery is in full recovery, which was collapsed in like the 1950s or so.
Right.
Through in 1997, the government, the House and Senate passed a bill within the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, which is our sustainability as a country. They amended that by 2012, all oceans, lakes, streams, and offshore fishing was under sustainable quota managed by 2012. So here we are, 2025.
Because they were overfishing these things.
Yeah, they were overfishing. Yeah. They weren't keeping up with the science. And now the science has caught up also with fishing, and it's a good
fishing joint. Shellfish on like lobster.
Yeah.
Now we have more lobster than we've had.
Because I was going to say, I heard that on the East Coast, they're still under problems, that lobster is still overfished, or the cod.
The cod is under quota management now.
Yeah.
It didn't get put under quota management quick enough in Canada. They collapsed the fishery. They cut back the East Coast cod fishery on George's Bank, where I had the pleasure of working a little bit as a young kid. Cod, haddock, pollock, ocean cat is what we used to catch. But that was on the verge of collapsing as well.
Right.
Everything is under management now, so we don't take from the ocean more that can reproduce to keep the
and
levels.
How do they police that? I mean, do they actually pull up and look at the boats and what you've
like
got?
Like the lobster, they decide that, we have an idea. Why don't we put back the female lobster back in the ocean so we can have reproduction?
Yeah, they don't take eggers. Yeah, no females.
I didn't know that.
Right? But, now that we have that, small boats and families are able to fish again and turn their boats over to their children. So I'm dealing a lot more with children of people that are retiring, mm-hmm. and their children are taking over the boats.
Because I did live in San Pedro in the 80s and 90s, or in the 90s rather, and that was when the small boats were collapsing.
Yes, yeah, well, that was during the collapse of the rockfish fishery,
right.
yeah. black cod, everything else.
Fortunately, now people understand that we need to support the fishermen, and we pay, of course, an higher price for good fish, but at least pay the price so we fishermen can make a living. You
know? Yeah, good fish isn't cheap, and cheap fish isn't good.
Cheap
yeah.
fish isn't good. That's it. So that's my next yeah. question.
There's but a lot, you know, of... I'll throw a point out there for your listeners to understand is, over 92% of all seafood consumed in the United States of America is imported.
That's what I was
going to say. And it's not imported with the same stringent guidelines that our aquaculture follows mm-hmm. or our wild fishers follow. Yeah. We are the blueprint for the rest of the world, yet we as consumers, we like cheap and
yeah.
we import.
So you know? That was my question. You led me right there. What's the state of... the fisheries around the world that we're buying from, are we overfishing those areas?
They're being overfished, and it's not only overfishing. You have countries such as North Korea and South Korea, China. They're in a live for now attitude.
Yeah.
So if it's there, they're going to catch it.
Right.
And they're going to consume it. So.
And what about the way they catch it, too? Because that was the whole problem with they're doing when they were doing deep, whatever, nets or something here. They're scooping up everything trying
yeah,
to get it.
Per se nets where...
Per se nets,
just
yeah.
imagine, you know, there's so many poke restaurants. How much fish can we catch?
What a question.
Sushi and poke, yeah, it's crazy.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, huh? And...
So they're still doing that where they put these giant nets and they scoop
the
up
circular,
everything?
Yeah, the circular nets
and
that
then
go
they
down
throw,
a mile.
And they then throw they, most of it out because it's not what they wanted. Yeah.
They pull it in, and there's a lot of bycatch, marine animal bycatch. That's why you have what's called dolphin-safe tuna in America.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And all they did is they went offshore, then they left San Diego, they left San Pedro, and they went to... Samoan Islands and offshore where mm-hmm. they have aka dolphin safe, but it's not U.S. dolphin
yeah,
safe
yeah.
but it still goes on your grocery store shelf as dolphin safe yeah. So there are porpoises and pilot whales and things in that can of tuna that you have, but
I'm sorry to hear that
it has the stamp on it that the consumer
you
buys.
Know, the key, pay the price.
Yeah.
Buy a can of tuna. Just
yeah.
Let's go one step further.
There's a lot of great... AmericanTuna.com is a great place to go to buy your tuna. Those are fishers out of San Diego County, pole in line, or where they have zero bycatch.
Exactly.
And if you want very good fish, you don't have access. Because now, Paddy also work with another fish company with very... one of the best.
Yeah, Superior Seafood, which is owned by Paul DiGiarmo, who is the son of one of those squid fishermen that you might have seen in San Pedro back in the day.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sicilian immigrants, yes.
They're very respectful for generation.
Yeah, generational. And
so the other question that I have is, what's the state of the fish, in addition to being overfished, we're always worried about what are these fish ingesting? Mercury, crap,
well,
pesticides.
Mercury is one of those things. Is mercury exists in? It's a naturally occurring phenomena. It settles within water, and within water, it settles into plankton. Plankton are the kind of the sponge of the ocean. They're the canary of the ocean as well.
Right.
And then your lower species, such as squid, mackerel, sardines, they eat the phytoplanktons
right.
in mass quantities. So because they are lower on the chain where they're eating so much of the phytoplanktons, they are the ones that have the higher concentration of mercury. So which fish that you consume eats the most mercury would be the fish that consume those fish, which is your sharks, your tunas, and your swordfish. Those are the ones you'll have the higher mercury content.
And usually bigger the fish is, more chance he has more mercury.
Yeah, the bigger the fish that eats, lower on the food chain
is
pretty much the answer
Yet,
to that.
Yet American diet has moved away from, at least what I grew up in the Midwest, meat, potatoes kind of thing, that descendant of the Irish cuisine, the English cuisine, too much more seafood. it's supposed to be healthier and better for you.
Seafood, no matter what, is even not farmed well, is healthier than land-based proteins that are done in equally bad farming conditions. Okay, yeah, so right. One of the things to think about when it comes to aquaculture and like farm salmon, for instance, they grow a lot faster with a lot less feed. And the number one reason is they don't have this thing to deal with called gravity that a chicken has to. Mm-hmm. So their energy output that they put compared to a land-based animal that has to sit on 2 feet or 4 feet upright versus gravity, they will ultimately consume less. So we can feed more people through aquaculture than we can with land-based.
Never heard that.
Yeah,
never
but at the same time, we got to do it right.
There's a lot of you don't want to give them, you know, bad food.
Yeah, there's a lot of
make them fat. You know, this.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of farms out there, if people do their research, that do the right job. There's a lot of farms out there that have great marketing.
Yeah,
that don't do the right job. You have to kind of trust your.
They grow in the wild, but they're actually in a park.
Yeah,
and in that park, you know this. They eat from each other. You know, it's terrible.
Really.
Well, and we are actually polluting the ocean because of that.
Yeah. Well, you have one of the basic things to keep in mind is on the aquaculture feed in North America, South America, Canada. The majority of feed comes from two companies, and the main ingredient in the feed is dehydrated pork blood from land-based commodity farming.
This is the pellets or something they feed the fish?
Yep. Chicken feather meal, chicken carcass meal, chicken fat meal. And then they have some land-based vegetable proteins from corn, well, from soy, and they have corn. But those are from genetically modified crops that go into that.
Oh, great.
So, and then they have a little bit of fish oil. So they'll talk about how they've diminuted the fish oils. And they'll say we have land-based vegetable proteins in it. And then they'll keep the chicken feathers and the pork blood, which is the majority of the feed, out of the conversation.
Terrible diet.
Yeah. And of those companies, one is owned by Bayer, which is the owner now of Monsanto, and the other is DuPont. So
chemical companies.
These are chemical companies that own the fish.
They put that in the ocean.
So this is what you know, and the same thing for the land-based chickens and things. Is like you have to. Why would you buy wild fish from a local fisherman for more money than a farm fish cheap in a grocery store?
Talking about that,
you're getting the proper nutrition.
People think, it's going to be a wild salmon. I'm buying Atlantic salmon,
right?
It's not from Atlantic salmon. It's a breed.
Yeah.
And can you
Atlantic salmon is the name that you see that in. That's the most common fish.
Always.
Probably 50% of all seafood companies, 50% of what we sell, I hate to say, is Atlantic salmon.
Yeah.
In mass quantities. And you'll see it on every, you know, so many restaurant menus. And Atlantic salmon is actually the species of wild salmon for the Atlantic ocean. All right. When I was a young boy, it was even then it was under quota management, and my grandfather used to take us into Canada, and we could only buy from the Indian tribes and Atlantic salmon. And they found that salmon was good for aquaculture, first started in Norway back in the day.
That it could be tamed and grown in mass.
There was a very slow learning curve when it came to aquaculture on that, but they've got it down now. So now it becomes commodity in a lot of ways in farming. Mm-hmm. And there are farms that are doing the right thing with their feed, everything else.
Like Scottish?
Yeah, Scottish, I would say 85% of Scottish is great.
Yeah.
There is the 15% companies that use whale oils within their feed, you know, and they don't, you know, of course, they don't market that, but it's cheaper because they do still have the right to kill whales up in that area.
Up in Norway, especially.
Yeah, in Norway as well. So the problem, and I'll tell you, I've been on the other side of the stove for a long time, and I've been deep in, I would say, the bowels of distribution in the industry.
Literally the bowels of distribution.
And I worked pretty much undercover with Greenpeace, Humane Society back in the day.
Wow, okay.
I was part of finding out things that we didn't really, we wish we didn't know once we knew it, you know, but it's the reality of our food system being owned so much by Wall Street, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Very few companies own our companies. You know, you look at even Whole Foods Markets owned by Amazon now. Yeah. It's like, it's not the same as it used to be. It's not terrible, but it's like once you look into the farms that they're now buying from, the names of the individual farms you'll see, and I already see it in Whole Foods, the names are disappearing.
Yeah,
and they're the
because
names
it's
of
about
farm,
it's about profit.
It's about
it's
profit,
about, exactly. And it's about the bottom line and how to grow the bottom line rather than sustain a generational.
Well, that's
business.
Why we need to educate the buyer on the the people that eat fish. Can we check on the website of the Monterey Aquarium?
Well, Monterey Bay Aquarium, fantastic starting point. You know, it is a starting point. They're mainly funded by the Hewlett-Packard Foundation. Fantastic. You know, they've done a great job with their green, red, yellow. Green, this is good. Yellow is good, but it has some issues, possibly bycatch issues, whatever. Red, please don't eat that. But as a group and an aquarium themselves, they can only do...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if somebody's coming, we want to talk to you.
Oh, no. Coming in. Incoming.
Hello.
Salut, Pascal.
Hey, qui c'est? Oh, c'est Christian. Salut, toi.
We're getting a live phone call.
C'est Patrick.
Salut, Patrick.
Hey, ça va, toi? T'es où, là? C'est Florida, international? Miami, super. Says they're one of the best chefs on the entire planet.
He's calling in from Miami?
Yeah.
Yes. And he used to be the chef at the Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah. Yeah, he was my chef, yes.
Well, there you go. Have him call in on the line here. We'll put him on the air. He can call in on the phone.
Can you give a number?
If he calls 949-824-1200.
Okay.
Call that, and we'll put you on the air. 949-824-1200.
824-1200.
Right. Call that number and we'll put you on the air.
Okay. Oh, wow. Quelle surprise. What a surprise.
Okay. I'll call you right back.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow. So they're calling in.
Christian Rossinou, he has mentored some of the greatest chefs in America still around today.
And where is he currently in Miami?
He's in Miami, Florida. And he was very big within the Ritz-Carlton group. And he was the Ritz-Carlton Laguna Niguel here. And when the Ritz-Carlton Laguna Niguel was the jewel of the coast, of the whole West Coast.
Yeah.
And from his kitchen, some of the most famous chefs you know today have worked through that kitchen with Christian.
Everybody remember him?
Yeah,
there is not like a week that somebody asked me, "What happened to Christian? What is he doing?"
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing.
Oh, he's in Miami.
Yeah. Distinguished artist, artist not just in food but in painting.
Yes.
He's an incredible painter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, incredible.
He's a philosopher. Really.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're still waiting for him to call in here.
So
maybe
when we come back after the call, and we will come back on land. And so we move out of the ocean, we come back almost on land, both. Yeah. Coastal and land, we have
While we're waiting for him, let me ask you one other question. This is just me as somebody who likes to go out and eat seafood in Southern California. Two questions. One, I don't see a lot of great seafood anymore in California. Is that just too expensive and too hard to get? And when I do get, maybe this is just me, an old grumpy guy, it doesn't seem to taste the same. Is that my perception or is that some reality? Harder to get?
You probably have to do a little bit more younger research and where you go.
Okay.
There are some great chefs in Orange County, San Diego, L.A., breaking barriers down, national barriers down. I have a young chef, Tara Masood, in San Diego. She runs Anime, Filipina chef. She's been nominated a few times now for the James Beard National Award.
Okay.
Incredible thing, but she's bringing, she works with the local fishermen in San Diego. I have a lot of chefs, like, we do well as a company. And when they're interested in doing that type of work, that they want to work with a local fisherman, I do have fishermen that work directly with the I have fishermen that work directly with the restaurants, and we try to connect them together. It's not as easy than chefs like
I'll
to pick up chefs like to pick up the phone and call and have their fish delivered the next day and not think it through, but. These young chefs are
949-824-1204.
We're still trying to get
him. We're still trying to get him on. He's a great chef, but he can't figure out the phone system here.
1200. D'accord? Okay.
So I'm wondering if it's what you're talking about. We're getting it overseas. They're growing them wrong. It doesn't taste the same.
I think especially since COVID, people have simplified down and they've had to cut their staff down because it's so expensive for staff now. There is a lot of great restaurants out there, but you have to do a little bit more research these days.
Okay. You know? Hang on 1 second. We'll put you on. Hang on. See if this will work. Are you there? Welcome. Welcome to OC Talk Radio. You there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. What a surprise.
Identify yourself. Tell us who you are and why are you calling?
Well, I'm Christian Racineau. I used to be, before I retired, I used to be executive chef for Ritz-Carlton for many years.
Wow. And Laguna Niguel or whatever. Laguna, yeah.
Yes. And I had, yesterday I was talking to Pascal, and Pascal told me to call back today because a good friend would be there, which is Patrick.
Wow. So what a surprise.
So do you accept what they're telling you? They're telling me that you're one of the great chefs here, that you've mentored all sorts of people, and everybody's still wondering what happened to you.
No, I'm just a chef amongst many.
So how do you know this guy? How do you know our guest?
Well, Patrick used to work for me, and I...
Was he any good? We're still trying to figure that out. Was he any good?
Can you give us a secret?
He was fantastic. I mean, he was going like 100 miles an hour. Very, very hard to... Ask him to take a day off and to work only 12 hours a day.
To work only 12 hours a day. He wanted to keep going.
Yes, yes. He was just going and going. He was just amazing man. And then very, very creative and great with the staff, great trainer. I mean, he was, nobody's perfect, okay? But he was about, like, perfection.
So how did we lose him to the supply side? How did we get him out of the kitchen into being a supplier here? Should we get him back into the kitchen?
I forget that.
I was with C'est avec Philippe, Philippe Levet.
Yes, you work with Philippe, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm sure they were, Philippe was always, saying a lot of good things about you.
Yeah, yeah.
When there was...
But Paul, when you've been working like 30 or 35 years, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, you at one point say, I need to revise my...
Yeah.
Enough.
Well, it's good. There's a common friend amongst all of us, Phil Levy, French-Algerian family. They own Fish Warehouse in L.A., took care of all the top chefs of the time. Yeah. Of that that generation, and he was one of my best friends. And he said, "Hey, come with me." I was burnt out. I was tired. A lot of the way restaurants, if Chef remembers, a lot of restaurants in L.A. And friends that he had that worked with him went on. The funding wasn't what it was supposed to be, A lot of people were doing funny business back in the day.
They call it funny business?
Yeah, you get tired of putting your heart and soul in a place that really, on paper, didn't exist,
I feel like we are up to the bear show right now.
Yeah, Phil said one time I was taking over a project with some big people on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. I was burnt out.
There you go.
We had a record label with Capitol Records. We had a nightclub attached to it. And literally, I was opening the door, and there was no money in the bank at all. And they wanted me to fire the door open. I'm like, I have 80 employees, and they expect a paycheck. And I couldn't do it anymore. I've been through it too many times, and Phil said, come with me. And that's when it actually happened back then.
That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, and a common friend with Christian and myself, Phil, is one of the best. Yeah.
So how has it changed? Our guest has been around a long time. You say you're retired now? Chef Pascal says you never retire. There's no such thing as retiring.
I don't think Christian was totally retired.
I retired just before COVID and started a company actually in China to produce some creative sauces and cold and hot. And then we were doing very well with foreign hotels, with Hilton and Mandarin, and they were very interested in the sauces. And we were supposed to start production in January 20. And you know what happened then? Everything stops.
So, Chef Christian, would love if you come to Orange County to come and talk more about.
Please, we'd love to hear about those days at the Ritz-Carlton. You know,
and I'll say this to Christian again. Christian has impacted more lives in the culinary world than anyone else around. He has so many young chefs that came up through him, through his mentoring, that have gone off to do great things in America and abroad and around the world. He's truly one of the greatest that ever graced the stove.
I'm sorry to have to say for this big high-end chain hotel, but you made the Ritz-Carlton going up a notch above all the other hotels in Orange County in the U.S., actually.
That was the place. That was the place.
Yes.
So I got to ask Christian one question here, because Chef Pascal keeps bringing these young chefs in, and none of them want to work behind the kitchen door. They all want to have a food truck. They all want to have a food hall, a stand. They all want to have a food line or a product. They all want to be on TV and sell T-shirts or sell books. Is it a different world? You guys did anything to get behind the kitchen door, and you worked for nothing, for hours, forever.
That was passion.
Is it different?
I don't want to say that we worked for nothing, but
you were fanatics.
I mean, there was passion. You know, you have to be passionate to work in this business. You know, you deal. You know, I always say there's only two types of food in the world. It's good and bad. No matter what it is, you know, if it's a simple burger, it has to be the best you ever done. If you go as a customer, you go to a restaurant and order, you know, a dish for $300 or a dish for $17, it doesn't matter what comes out of the kitchen.
They've got to be good.
Has to be perfect, because you expect perfection.
Yeah.
And if it's perfect, you will go back to that restaurant.
So the three of you have seen many restaurants. Do you think it's different today? Certainly different how they work. Our guest was saying you can't do fine French cuisine because it takes too many hours. It takes too much prep. It takes too much staff. Too much staff to do it. So that's why that's not going to happen anymore.
But I think this is more our vision in California. If you go to the East Coast
Chicago, New York, the clientele there will pay the price it costs to produce that.
Okay.
I mean, you have like Le Bernardin in Grand Achat in Chicago. You have places that the people understand that a $350 tasting menu is normal, and the wines are going to be in the $800 range.
Wow.
And they will come Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
every day.
Whereas in California, I hate to say, is it gets busy on Friday and Saturday, and then what do these restaurants do Monday through Thursday to support this staff?
Taco Tuesday.
You know, a lot of our restaurants since COVID, I deal with mostly the high-end restaurants and chefs, and you know, we'll take care of anybody, we'll educate anybody, we'll take care of whoever wants to buy good product from us. But They've closed on Mondays and Tuesdays now. Major restaurants. In the old days, you would never be closed. I have a restaurant. We're going to be open. You know.
Yeah. And it's hard. How do they? How does that work out financially? Because you're still paying higher rents than ever, higher labor costs than ever. How can you be closed for two or three days?
Actually, you know, it does help on cut on labor. You have to do that.
If you're doing, if you're between a someone, even at the someone at the register or a host, say in a fine dining,
right.
You have a hostess, you have at least one waiter, a bartender, at least one busboy, at least one dishwasher, one prep cook, one cook, all right, and a manager, right? Your payroll for lunch is $1,500, but you only do $800 in receipts for the day.
Right.
There's no sense to be open on a Monday.
Right.
You know?
Let them go home.
And for lunch sometimes. Yeah. You know, depending on the location, but most of the time, you know, just open for dinner.
We just had two major restaurants who were very good in Miami who just closed in like in 2 months' time.
Wow.
Just because they could not afford the rent anymore.
We're looking at some.
And the expense.
Some of the rents that we have now, like Dana Point Harbor is being redone. I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know the numbers. And there's a new project that just opened in San Juan Capistrano.
The food hall?
Well, they're paying $17 plus
a
square foot.
We need to send a message to you know? to all the landlords of retail landlords in Orange County. Come on, give us a break.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why... a lot of these big companies in Orange County, for instance, Orange County is owned by very few companies.
Right.
Don't mention names.
And I won't, I won't mention names.
They'll come down on us here.
And, but they, to get a lease with them, you have to be financially independent yourself. So the independent chef can't really afford to sign a five-year lease with these groups because it costs too much money. So ultimately, they have to take in investors and all that. And by the time the chef gets to open the front door, he really doesn't own much.
He's already broke.
He's already broke. So that's why we have more like chain restaurants in Orange County, for instance.
I agree. Well, just to give you a perspective, everybody listening, 20 years ago, I owned a small restaurant and bar, mostly a bar, called Kelly McHugh's in Mission Viejo. We were 5,000 square feet, which was pretty big for that. We were paying in 1990, in the early 90s, $1 a foot.
Wow. Yeah, great. Wow.
$1 a foot.
We'll open 10 restaurants with that today.
Yeah. How could I pay 15? And I, you know, like everybody, we made 10, 15% on our investment. So we grossed $1 million. We made $100,000 or a couple hundred thousand dollars. We were thrilled. And today, if you take my rent and turn it into $10, $15, I can't afford that.
The restaurant turn about 2 to 3% profit. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, you know, we're like the OGs, the old guard.
You are,
Or I think they call it...
the old original gangsters.
Original gangsters, yeah.
the goats.
Yeah, the goats. But, you know, the young chefs now, I see a surge now, especially since COVID. I see a surge now of young chefs and more ethnic chefs that are really changing the dial and opening doors for more people. And, you know, they have the internet. They've grown up with the internet, so they can research stuff in a flick of a hat, where we would have to go and live in the attics of restaurants and have to work just to get closer to see how they did something. They can YouTube it now at any time, so they can work outside of their their own training very easily with the internet help, but also the amount of ingredients that they have, the amount of ingredients
that
the international trade and sourcing is at a much higher level than we were ever privy to.
So one last question for Christian, then we'll let him go here because it's 3 hours later in Miami here. One question for you, as you listen to this, does it make you want to get back in, or are you glad you got out?
Well, you know, I've been doing consulting and task force.
Always,
Because, you know, retirement is too boring, so I've been doing that. And I'm very happy. I do lecture in hotel schools and work with hotels. And but I just want to, you know, just want to say something.
Sure.
You know, talking about the younger generation of chefs, What I miss today is the passion. Mm. You know, I just give you you were talking about gourmet cuisine. To me, yes, it's very nice to see a beautiful plate. Looks great in the picture, but how about the flavor? You know, too often I'm missing the flavor. Mm-hmm. And I just come back from Europe, you know, Italy, France, and Switzerland, and went to too many restaurants. And unfortunately, the great majority of the restaurants are just okay.
Yeah.
I give you an example, okay? I was going through the street of Arles. Arles is a beautiful city in Provence, close to the Mediterranean. There is a beautiful arena that was built by the Roman. And I was looking for a restaurant, going through the street, and I hear somebody singing, okay? So I tell to my wife, oh, listen to that. So we go, turn around in the street there, and there's a gentleman who's singing very loud, and he's setting up table. So I go to him, I says, you know, if your food is as good as your singing and your joie de vivre,
we'll stay.
I'm going to come and have lunch. And we did have lunch there, and it was fantastic. It was not expensive. It was fantastic. And after that, I spoke to the chef, and I told him, I said, thank you, because your cuisine is not pretentious, but it was excellent. And if I was living in Arles, I would come back every day.
Yeah. And Christian, you are so totally right. You know, I like to travel with groups in everywhere in Mediterranean, Greece, and Turkey. And I always look for a little mom-and-pop restaurant in the corner, not the tourist place.
Because they still have the passion.
They do.
Yeah. Well, I tell you guys, we just had Green Feast, fundraising.
Talk about that.
The fundraising table at the Ecology Center in San Juan, and we've been a part of that for 18 years. And I was tired. I had worked at work. We've had long hours with a computer change at work. You know, we broke that 100-hour week for a couple of weeks. Okay. We're tired. And I went there to work, and I was working, and I was running from one kitchen to the other with ingredients. And the pastry chef, the baker, Veronica, she had done some sourdough flatbreads. And I have to tell you, I took one bite, and I might have been extremely hungry, but I got to tell you, it was one of the best bread I've ever eaten in my entire life.
Wow.
And that was a young chef today doing that. And it's from the heart, like Christian was saying, from passion, the ingredients that went into it, how she did it, the 3-day fermentation.
So it doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be difficult.
Simple can be simple with flavor, like chef says.
Cook with love and passion and use the best ingredient to deliver the best food.
Love it. Anything else you want to say? Thank you so much for calling in. What a pleasure to talk to you. We should have you on for your own segment sometime.
One of my favorite people in my entire life is calling in, and one of the other favorite people in my entire life is sitting across from me.
I'm almost a love fest. We got a love fest going on here.
And I hope Christian is still painting, because he's an amazing painter.
Yes. There you go.
All right. Christian, thank you for calling. It was so nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Allez, ciao. Merci, Jeff.
Stay in touch. We love you.
And come on again sometime when you got more time. We'll tell more stories of the Ritz-Carlton and all that.
Anytime. Love it.
Thank you so much. We're going to cut you off here.
Have a nice
All right. So,
bye-bye.
Now.
Wow, okay.
We moved from ocean to land, and you mentioned the Ecology Center.
Right, we got 5 minutes.
Just quickly say what's your involvement or what the Ecology Center brings to us.
Well, tell us what it is, because I never heard of it.
The Ecology Center was founded 18 years ago by Evan Marks, who is a horticulturist, who had done a lot of work in South America getting farmers in more modern land-based techniques.
How they grow it.
And he's an incredible individual, passionate, and he got the grant from the city of San Juan Capistrano to take over a small building, which is the oldest wooden structure in South Orange County. It was part of the Pony Express back in the day.
Oh, my goodness.
And he had the farmhouse of this farm, and about an acre, 3/4 of an acre. And after around COVID, the farmer that had the lease for the land came to the end of his lease, and the city gave the land over to the Ecology Center. And they have since taken that farm, which was doing mostly like cucumbers and strawberries. And they had a farm stand, but they bought the vegetables in. And now the Ecology Center is doing well over 600-700 varietals a year,
yeah,
from cover crops to...
Is this what they call heirloom crops? You know,
there are heirloom crops within that too, but they are a regenerative farm, or organic regenerative farm, where
everything is homegrown.
Yeah, so they take dirt and create it into soil.
They even have a little cafe, no?
Yeah, and now they have a cafe that's open now Wednesday till Sunday from noon to 8 p.m., one set menu the whole time, and everything is produced there on the farm. And I got to tell you, when you talk about flavors, the flavors that come from the simpleness of the food that they do is there because of how it's grown.
And they have a wood burning oven.
Yeah.
Everything.
It's just done with
and
passion.
It's also a place where you can learn, especially a lot of schools take classes there to learn about the ecology of living, you know. Don't use the plastic. Use special
tools.
Yeah,
it's all about ecological, sustainable thinking. Yeah.
Don't just pour fertilizer into the soil.
Exactly.
Into the soil.
Evan has every cycle. He has a group of young students that want to be organic regenerative farmers.
Mm-hmm.
He trains them how to do it properly. And they go off, and they're starting to sprinkle around the country now. They're starting to retrain. So we're getting our farming back away from commodity farming, and Ecology Center is like a hub of that positive work that's going on.
We're
going
to bring Evan.
He's so articulate in his mission, and he's well supported within the community. But they also have a lot of school children, things like, you know, we're detached from our food.
Totally.
Right? We're detached from chickens. We're attached from rabbits. We're attached from our lamb.
I've said this to the chef all the time. I never knew where food came from. It came from the store.
Yeah. But they're taking growing to the level of teaching children about how to turn dirt into soil.
And can
soil,
I just,
yes.
I'm going to make one more comment, and then we got to go here. I'm going to make one more comment. Here's my comment. A few years ago, when I really got into food and started going on to restaurants, I got a chance to go taste some heirloom stuff straight from a farm. A tomato. I thought I knew what a tomato tastes like because they all taste the same. I thought, no, there's a million of them. And the flavor, the explosion of flavor. You've tasted an apple or a tomato or something?
You know when you have a good tomato?
When
you smell.
Yeah.
Okay. Never
if you take a tomato in the store, there's no smell.
None. No.
But if you take it from the... from the vine, from the field. Yes, sense.
See?
Yeah.
So it isn't just it's good for you or it's good for the ecology, it's good for the land, the soil, everything. Yes, all of that's true. But it's good tasting. You're talking about the best ingredients, yeah.
We used to eat tomato just like that, like an apple.
Right.
And so now,
last comment.
One last thing. It doesn't work enough. A few years ago, he decided to have his own oyster farm. Can you
We could talk an hour. I love oysters. We could talk forever about oysters.
We have the largest farm in the Pacific Northwest. It's called Clausen Oyster. It's a 680 bay acreage farm where we have both off-bottom and on-bottom cultured oysters. And we were also my proudest point of Clausen Oyster is we were able to create 4 reefs of oysters now that we haven't had a count or a drone account of what's there, but each reef must be over 2 million native Olympia oysters.
Wow.
But we were able to get them to spawn in the wild by just simple manipulation. And I hate to say, I think we my farm manager Chris and I in our talks, and he's a genius. He's one of the people in my life that I know that kid is a genius. By putting some mother shell down from the Pacific oysters, the Crossatreus gigas, into the beds, the spat had collection points that were able to create these reefs, and I think that we out-farmed the scientists on that, because they've had much failure of doing land-based oyster sets. Yeah.
You create an ecosystem of growth.
So this isn't in a bay in the ocean?
It's in the bay. It's in it's what's called Coos Bay.
Know why it's in the bay, because oysters live to have tides.
Yeah.
Up and down. They need to move with the ocean.
The valve.
Well, I believe the native Olympia oysters, which were from Canada to Baja, Mexico, they were wiped out during the gold rush years for a food source. But I also believe, and I haven't proved it yet, but I'm pretty sure it was Indian gentrification, a different way of, that was the millennial way, the millennium way of eating for the coastal tribal Indians was a lot of oysters.
Yeah.
And
some people speculate that even on the East Coast, that the first Thanksgiving wasn't meat and potatoes like it is now. It was probably had oysters.
Oh yeah, mostly they had oysters and fish.
The tribes that lived along.
But I believe
that was the turkey of the sea.
I believe the decline of the Olympia oysters, as well as over harvesting, was part of it.
Yeah.
I believe Indian gentrification of trying to starve the tribes out was another part of it. So we work with the Coquille Indian tribe there, and we don't grow those Olympias for consumption or for sale. We grow simply for the health of the bay.
Yeah.
And I think if there's anything I've done within oyster farming, outside of we're able to produce some of the best oysters with our own techniques that we created, not knowing anything, literally we created by not knowing anything, was that we were able to set those four large reefs now as a success.
How can we get you oysters?
Basically, we're not shipping directly right now, but if you're in North Bend, Oregon, which is in Coos Bay, our restaurant is open Wednesday through Sunday.
And what's it called?
It's called Clausen Oyster Farm.
Like
Clausen, like the pickle, C-L-A-U-S-E-N.
Okay.
And we are in North Bend, a beautiful space. And the restaurant literally overlooks the bay, and you're eating while workers are working around you.
Love it.
I'm surprised that Paddy didn't move there.
We work up there a lot, and it's beautiful. A lot of plane miles, but
you work out. I see him flipping bags on big sack of oysters.
It's fantastic, and what it's great. You know, the oyster farming is hard work. It is, but incredibly beautiful. If you
connect,
our office is outside, you know, during the winter time is the low tides, for instance, and harvesting is done at night. So you have to be pretty hardy to walk in mud. You're sinking with 1 foot while you're pulling the other foot.
The mud flats as the water has pulled out.
The mud flats, and you are working at night. You're wet. It's cold. It's raining. It's 35 degrees outside.
Unbelievable.
But the work still got to get done. You know.
So one last thing I want to say, besides all your work, your hard work, and your dedication to top food, if you ever know you're in a business and you need help, you just call Paddy.
He's there.
No problem. I get you that. You know,
yeah.
If you forget, I used to forget sometimes to order something for a fish for the next day. I deliver it.
No problems. The customer service is still part of it.
I come over.
He brings it in in a cooler or something.
It's amazing. Dedication.
And while I'm on the air, I challenge all the chefs listening to look at your menu and try to find one spot for one thing on your menu that you can shake a farmer's hand or a rancher's hand or a fisherman's hand to get that product on your menu, as opposed to just buying through purveyors and losing the connection you have with your food.
At one point, some chef used to put the name of the fisherman on the menu for each fish.
Really?
But Right now, it's very hard to because you don't really know where.
I don't know where. Yeah, you don't know where it comes from. It's gone exactly, through so many middlemen, particularly if it's been imported. Who knows where it really.
But, well, and I hope in that sense, Pascal, that the chefs that put the names of the farmers on the menu actually buy from those farmers.
Yes, true.
You know, we've
not for show.
Recommended by Paddy Glenn.
Yeah. We at Superior Seafood like to call it consciously sourced.
Yeah.
As in, yes, we try to buy from the proper fisheries, working with sustainable quota management, but also that there's no slavery involved, that there's no human rights activities involved. Like, you know,
and they get paid a fair wage. They don't get ripped off for whatever they're spending their life doing here.
Yeah. Well, you know, Thailand has the most human rights slavery within their tuna fishery. Mostly taking the people from Myanmar war that's going on, and putting them on board boats and
displaced people who have nowhere to go and they're desperate.
They're slaves, and if they don't follow what's being called, they're shot and thrown overboard.
Oh my God!
All you have to do is Google it. It's not making it up.
Oh my God!
But 80% of the tuna consumed in the United States comes from Thailand, and everyone's just quietly supporting that.
Two things in Orange County, actually in Newport Beach, where you can get fresh fish. You go to the dairy.
The Newport Dory Fleet,
Fleet.
Yeah, Saturday mornings, yeah.
Yeah, on the pier, on the Balboa Peninsula.
Oh, that's where you can get really fresh fish.
Yes.
Also,
not at the supermarket?
You can get live ocean too.
Yeah. And Pearson's Port is all
Pearson's Port.
Pearson
you
got
to bring
well,
it back because we're out of time. Yeah. We're way over
Pearson
out of time.
Pearson's Port, if you want to have Santa Barbara prawns live,
Pearson's Port is a great, my God, I wish people would shop there more.
You know? Come back again. Tell us more. Thank you. How do they reach you if they want to learn about any of these things you're doing, your work? All four or five things you rattled off. Where do you want to send people to learn more about it?
You know, we're not a website kind of people. Funny, Superior Seafood's a big company. We don't even have a website. Yeah. We're a huge company. Word of mouth is like, you know, your website is only as good as whatever you put up today. Yeah. So, you know, my cell is 949-975-9699.
Your cell?
People are going to call you? You can also find me on Instagram. DM me is probably the best, you know.
Yeah.
But
it under Patrick or Patty?
Patty Fishmonger.
Patty Fishmonger.
Patty Fishmonger.
Patty the Fishmonger. Okay, thank you, Patty the Fishmonger, for joining us. Pascal, take us out.
It's a pleasure to be here with Pascal.
Oh,
my gosh.
You're welcome.
My dear friend.
Yes. Merci.
Wow, all that and more. That's what's happening behind the kitchen doors. Tune in to hear more from the man who spent many, many years there and is bringing many friends along. And many friends he's making along the way today and tomorrow. Behind the kitchen door, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios behind the doors here at UCI's Beal Applied Innovation Center.